Today our guest is Bronwyn Keith Hines' brand new album called Fiddler's Pastime. You might know Bronwyn from her time with the very, very fine bluegrass band Mile 12. Phenomenal fiddle player. You're going to enjoy this. I'm pretty certain that you're going to learn a lot about Bronwyn. You're going to hear a lot of great music. Thanks for tuning in. To the audience of Unreal Bluegrass, you just heard a great tune, Fiddler's Pastime, which happens to be the third cut on a brand new album from Bronwyn Keith Hines, who was my guest today on Unreal Bluegrass, which makes me very happy to have a chance to talk to Bronwyn. How are you?
I'm doing great, Steve. Thanks for having me.
I was so glad when you sent me this album a couple of weeks ago. It's full of wonderful compositions that you created and you borrow from other sources. You bring in a lot of great people to assist you on the music. And it's just 11 songs. I think, I forget how many that I have written down that you wrote, maybe four or five, something like that. But you bring in so many great people, and you're playing, we talked a little bit this off the air, your playing is very, very precise. And I asked you a little bit about your experience level to get that kind of sound. And I mentioned that to the audience. I mentioned to Bronwyn, Daryl Anger wrote liner notes, and I'm going to steal from his liner notes for just a second. Let me find the part that I want. Daryl Anger is a poet even when he doesn't mean to make it rhyme. That's not what he said, but I'll say this from the end of the fourth paragraph and end of the fifth paragraph, so when people get this at home, they can go read Daryl's liner notes. And this is, he's describing your playing. And I'm going to steal from him, and he wouldn't care. It's transcendent in a way that involves the whole body and adjusts us better than chiropractic. And the quality least susceptible to definition, question mark, the thing that evaporates into quanta, the finer we set the magnification. The heart, the soul, the clear flow of the human spirit out through a box made out of stuff that was once alive. I mean, that says everything you could possibly say about what I would try to get out of this interview. And so then Daryl says it there, but we're gonna put a little flesh to that description. The opening tune on the show is great. Tell me a little bit about, we know that you're a member of a very popular band in bluegrass, Mile 12. They've been very successful. I love the music. I play it on the show often, but talk a little bit about that band, its development, and how you got to this solo, and then I'll ask you to talk a little more about Fiddler's Pastime, the tune we just heard.
Yeah, totally. So I started Mile 12 up in Boston about 6.5 years ago. I say I started it, but four of us started all together. And it was just kind of a shared dream. You know, it was kind of just a couple of friends who would meet up and you know, jam at these parties and at the Cantab Lounge, which was kind of the local bluegrass bar. And I think we were all kind of at a place where we were playing a lot of local gigs and kind of wanted to tour and weren't sure how to go about doing that. So we were just like, well, why don't we just start our own band? And there's no rule, we can't do that, right?
No, there's not. No, there's not.
Yeah, so we just kind of said, what the heck? We'll see what happens, you know? So it's been, I don't think any of us expected it to go this far, probably, but it's been, you know, just really cool to see what happened with it. And gotten to travel to a lot of cool places that, a lot of cool countries. We ended up doing a tour in Japan about 2 years ago, which was sort of really a dream come true, and a bunch of European stuff and New Zealand and Australia. And yeah, it's just been a
Bronwyn, isn't it amazing when you go to a place like Japan and you think of culturally, why would they relate to bluegrass? There's a long history of the Japanese loving bluegrass, and it goes back a long, long time ago, but as a younger person who maybe didn't live through that when it was happening, I did, just because I knew bluegrass bands were going to Japan. When you play with the band doing bluegrass in Japan, what goes through your mind as you're realizing that these are very, very fanatic fans of the music?
Man, I mean, I felt like I would meet people who knew way more about bluegrass than I did, and that was definitely very humbling, you know? I don't know. It's just cool, and it's cool. It's a cool way to connect with people. You know, we did some like, kind of educational like workshops and outreach things. You know, where obviously we don't speak Japanese, and some of them didn't speak a lot of English, but you know, we're definitely still able to communicate stuff and even like make jokes and stuff. Just just with the music, you know.
There are bands, legendary bands, and I've had them guested on this program before, where they'll take the stage and they'll play bluegrass and they sing it and don't know the words. They're just saying it phonetically, but they get it right. But then off of the stage, they can't speak with you, but they can sound like a bluegrass band from West Virginia if they want to. And you think, wait a minute, there's something. The picture about this is odd. Then when you speak to them, you realize they just love it so much. They memorize it phonetically, and they just sing the heck out of it. It's a great place. I think all the countries that bluegrass has accepted would love Mile 12 and the music that you're doing now. But that's always been an interesting thing to me, going to taking a bluegrass, successful bluegrass band as you're in, to Japan and touring around the country after that also. I think it must be a fascinating experience.
Yeah, man, I really hope we can go back at some point.
I hope anybody can go anywhere soon at some point. I hope anybody can perform.
Yeah.
Listen, we opened the program with the title cut, which is the third cut on the album, Fiddler's Pastime, and you have someone playing with you on that who I don't know. And part of what I like to do in these discussions is tell me something about somebody I don't know. Lots of people fit that description, but Laura Orshaw I don't know at all, and she's with you on the tune that the audience just heard.
Oh, yeah, man, Laura Orshaw is one of my favorite fiddlers. She's from Pennsylvania, and we met up in Boston many years ago. She still lives there, and, man, she's been doing amazing in the bluegrass world. She was touring with Alan Bybee for a while and played on several of his albums, and most recently joined up with the Poe Ramblin' Boys just right before they were nominated for a Grammy, and has been touring with them, has been on their last record. And yeah, but we're friends from Boston for the last 10 years or so, and just got to play a lot of fiddle together, and so it just kind of felt fitting to have her on a twin fiddle track, because we've been doing so much twin fiddling at festivals, you know, at the Poe Ramblin' Boys and Miles Oliver at the same festival. We'll try to get together.
And now I feel foolish that I didn't recognize her name, but now you put it in the context, I understand now. I should have known her name right away, but you know, sometimes I try to read all the credits. I don't always get there. But so the tune you picked to play with her is not one that you wrote.
No, yeah, it's a Bill Monroe tune. Actually, I heard, you know, Daryl Anger actually recorded this tune on one of his albums, and I was reading something he wrote about it online that said that Bill Monroe had co-wrote it with Vassar Clements, but Bill got the writing credit. So I guess it's, according to Daryl, who I would believe, it's a Bill Monroe Vassar co-write, which I thought was like extra cool. Yeah, you know, I was kind of digging through old bluegrass instrumentals, trying to find something that would work well for twin fiddles, and this one seemed cool because it just had a lot to it. You know, it's three parts, and it's just got all these cool, just like quintessential bluegrass fiddle phrases, and I hadn't heard anyone else do it twin, so I just thought it could be a cool one.
Yeah, it works great. You've written several tunes on this. The very first one on the album, and I have to ask you, if I assume everything you put in a liner note is true, and if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Bronwyn Keith Hines about her new album, Fiddler's Pastime. But the very first song, Hendersonville Hop, you describe that as being derived from Space Limitations. I'll let you talk about how the song came about, because I think, really, did this happen? And tell the audience a little bit about what happened and how you describe it. That's amazing to me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, when I'm on tour with Miles Ball, we're all, like, desperate for practice time, and, like, you know, time by yourself is hard to find, so we're all always trying to fit ourselves into weird little spaces or you know, try to get away from people to play and not bug everybody else. So, you know, we were on tour, I think we were down in D.C., and we had a morning off, and we were staying at someone's house, and I didn't want to, like, be practicing there and sort of disrupting them because they were working from home, so I was trying to practice in our minivan, you know, and it was, it doesn't work, because BB's been doing that a lot on the banjo. She can go in the van and practice, and it works great, and I was like, well, I'll try that, but with the bow, I just kept hitting the ceiling. I was like trying to write this tune. I kind of got the A part there, but that's just like whenever I think of the tune, I remember that couple of hours.
and it's a great tune. And BB, who you mentioned, is the banjo player. She just won a kind of prestigious award in the world of bluegrass and banjo players.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. She won the Steve Martin Banjo Award.
Yeah. What a great thing for her. She's a wonderful player. Another part of that great band that you've discussed already in the origin of Mile 12. But, yeah, she's phenomenal. She's a phenomenal player.
Yeah. We were so happy for her.
Isn't that great? Isn't that the coolest thing in the world, especially in the time when you guys just can't get out to perform. So your income stream gets limited and more limited, and your concerts are canceled, and it gets more difficult. So what a great honor, but also then it doesn't hurt the fact that there's a little bit of remuneration with it that can help you through some difficult times.
Definitely.
You've chosen Tim O'Brien is on a couple of cuts on this, and I want to ask you why you chose his singing, and then we talked a little off the air about his musicianship, but we've got Tim O'Brien on a couple of these tunes, and how can you go wrong with Tim O'Brien, whether he's playing or singing or doing both?
Yeah, man, Tim is just one of my favorite, you know, bluegrass and acoustic musicians in general. So, and Miles Hall has done a little bit with him. We played a few shows, co-billing with him, or I think we opened for him a couple times. And yeah, and Tim's a cool musician too that I feel a connection to because we both have sort of a connection to the Irish music world as well. You know, he's done a lot in Irish music, and me as well. So whenever we cross paths, we kind of talk about that side of things too, sort of like all the Irish music people too. So I think I just feel an extra connection to his musicianship that way. So that's kind of, I mean, that's, yeah. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that the Minstrel Boy, that tune we recorded that he sang on, kind of comes out of that because it's an Irish poem from this poet named Thomas Moore. And I think it was, you know, it had a melody to it. And a lot of people have done it, but Tim kind of wrote his own melody to it. And I think that when we recorded it, it definitely has a bit of a Celtic flavor as well as the bluegrass thing.
You know, he did that album, and I'm trying to think of it as we're talking. I should have looked it up, but it's basically him going back to Ireland musically.
The Fiddler's Green.
Yeah, something like that. So he does that, and he does that wonderful stuff that pays tribute to that side of the Irish music, which I want to talk to you a little about also. Then he'll do something like the album Pompadour, where he's doing James Brown and all kinds of crazy music. He's all over the place, so I'm so glad that you pulled him in on that tune.
Yeah, for sure.
And he's probably a lot of fun to record with. I think he just must be an absolute professional. I think you have so many people on this album that I would say are pretty rock steady musically.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was cool. Like, that Minstrel Boy song with Tim was the last one we recorded. And, yeah, it was just, I don't know, it was the best vibe, I think, in the studio. I think he just kind of, like, he had this really just calm demeanor and kind of chilled everyone out. And it was, we arranged it in the studio. It was kind of really kind of spur of the moment, but it just kind of all gelled really easily. So it's really, really fun recording with him.
There's another song, and we'll talk about this before we're finished, the last cut on the album. I don't know why what you describe in the liner notes, and I want to talk to you about that in a minute, but you also wrote one of the tunes, Beautiful. Right now, I've written by it. It's currently my favorite tune. Now, that changes daily, but for right now, for this moment, Michelle's Waltz is just absolutely gorgeous, and I know what you wrote it about, but I want to give you the opportunity to maybe touch on that a bit. It's right now my absolute favorite tune on the album.
Oh, man, that's really cool. Yeah, I wrote it for a cousin of mine who passed away last year, kind of very unexpectedly. So it's kind of just a tribute to her.
My note next to it is gorgeous, and that means that's my favorite at this point. Just a beautiful waltz. And you also wrote, I'll say, North Garden?
Yeah. Yeah, North Garden was the area in Virginia that I grew up in. It's just south of Charlottesville, and I think it's technically like an unincorporated township, so it has a post office, and that's about it. But it's, I don't know, it's a beautiful place, and you know, I was just trying to think of, when I was trying to name these tunes, I was sort of, you know, kind of thinking, trying to think of maybe what they reminded me of or good memories from my past or, you know, just things that I wanted to pay tribute to, I guess. So that was one thing.
Wes Corbett is a phenomenal banjo player. He also produced this album, and you have several notes that mention his involvement. That'll lead us to a discussion of Happy Hollow, but I want you to talk a little bit about Wes Corbett and his involvement in this production.
Yeah, man, Wes did such an amazing job producing it. Wes is a longtime friend. we met up in Boston when he was teaching at Berklee College of Music, and I actually remember I took a semester of private lessons with him, just more like kind of musical lessons. He was playing banjo, and I think it was just kind of the start of a friendship. And when I moved down here, he and his wife actually let me rent a room at their house for a couple months while I was kind of getting my bearings. So that was a cool time. You know, I was all jazzed up about moving to Nashville, and we both loved to jam. So we'd kind of jam like almost every morning after breakfast for an hour or so, just to get warmed up before we like started our day. So that was kind of, you know, the start of me thinking about this album. You know, I was like, here's this person that I really like playing music with, who's also a bit of a mentor to me, who I feel like could kind of help steer me towards the kind of album I'm looking to make. And I'm all excited about being in Nashville and, you know, being around all these musicians. So it just kind of felt like the right time to at least put the first thing out, you know.
So the tune Happy Hollow, which is Wes on banjo, you fiddle, was that written in that time?
Actually, you know what? That's one that we used to jam on up in Boston. I think it's an old time tune. I think it was written by a banjo. I looked it up, a banjo player from I think North Carolina named Dora Evans.
I do have a note that says Dora Evans. You've never seen my handwriting, and I apologize for that. But when you said that, I can read it there, and I remember now. I rely on my notes, except for the fact that they're illegible. You're right, Dora Evans.
Good.
So Wes is, for the listeners, Wes appears in more places than you might recognize. Wes is a multi-talented, as good a banjo player and as inventive of a banjo player I've ever heard. He used to be part of a band, and I've totally forgotten this name too. It was the name of a song.
Oh, Joy Kills Sorrow.
Joy Kills Sorrow. Yes. I remember knowing the name of the song from Bela Fleck, but I don't know where he got it from. But he had a band called Joy Kills Sorrow, which was used to play them quite a bit back. I don't know what they're doing now. Whether they did what they said what they wanted to say and moved on. But that's where I first encountered Wes's playing. But great player. It's great to have somebody like that to help you pull these things together. This is kind of a big endeavor. We've talked about a lot of these songs. We're bouncing back and forth a little bit. But I want you to take a minute to introduce, we talked about The Minstrel Boy. So we're going to play that song now for the audience. You've pretty much described it already. And let me ask you this. When you record something, this was all recorded before, I will call it the COVID shutdown. Is that accurate?
Yes, it was just pre-COVID. It was recorded in late January and early February.
Okay.
So in my mind, I was about to release it at the beginning of the summer and tour it all year with Mile 12, but alas.
Yeah, alas. So well, you've described Minstrel Boy pretty well with Tim O'Brien. I'm going to play that now for the audience. Don't go anywhere for you. I'll come back and speak with you in just a second. So if you're just tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass, you're going to hear The Minstrel Boy from Bronwyn Keith Hines' new album, Fiddler's Pastime, which is on Sugar Petunia, Petunia Records, but that's close to a river. Mm-hmm. Sugar Petunia Records. but before I cut to this tune, they can find this. Give us a website, and I'll come back around to that later, but give us a website where they can find this.
Yeah, you can find it on www.BronwynKeithHines.com. That's BronwynKeithHines.
And there's no hyphen between the Keith Hines.
Yes.
On the website. I don't think it would throw them off too much, but
I have a lot of names.
Okay, that's okay. So let's play Minstrel Boy, and I'll come back and talk to you just a little bit more, and we'll talk about the rest of the album, what you're up to, and then we'll send you off with another tune. So hold on just a second.
Oh.
There, the audience heard a tune that we talked about quite a bit from Bronwyn's new album, Fiddler's Pastime, with Tim O'Brien. What a joy it must be to play. We've talked about this before, but what a joy, especially with this Irish connection. And you mentioned a little bit your early start into that type of music. I didn't let you speak much about it because I wanted to get into the album, but your first influence then, I think musically, was of an Irish flavor. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. And it was a little bit random. You know, I just happened to have a fiddle teacher who was into Cape Breton fiddling, and I played that for a little while, and then my family moved states, and then there wasn't any Cape Breton fiddling down in Virginia, so I got into Irish fiddling, which was the closest thing I could find, and I got really into that. And I also happen to have a bunch of Irish family. My whole dad's side, his parents immigrated from Ireland, so we would go over there a lot, especially when I was a teenager, to visit family. And I, you know, started bringing my fiddle and started participating in the jam sessions, and later, like, in the Irish fiddle contests over there and stuff, until I was about 17.
Boy, how much fun was that to go back to Ireland with relatives and relations there and taking your fiddle? That must have been a blast.
Yeah, it was super cool. I think they loved that I played, and they were all a little like, wow, that's cool. Like, none of us play. But here's this, like, American cousin of ours who's obsessed with Irish music.
The American cousin. There's either a movie or a book that comes to mind. I don't remember. that's an interesting story. So you were just exposed early, and because of that influence with your family, you got to be exposed in Ireland, so that's okay. That makes perfect sense. The perfect connection.
Yeah. But then, you know, I would like as I became a teenager, and I would go to these fiddle camps around the U.S. I started hearing bluegrass, and that's kind of that bug kind of bit me. And I knew some kids that were going to Berkeley, and I heard they had this American roots music program, and that a lot of like cool bluegrass bands were coming out of Boston, and that's kind of what made me move to Boston and go to Berkeley. Well, when I started playing bluegrass.
It's a great place to go. So many great players. I've had discussions with artists in the past about years ago, because I wasn't very inventive, I called the Berkeley effect. And by that I mean I spend a lot of time at Grey Fox. I go to Grey Fox Bluegrass Festival every year, and they kind of let me roam around and listen and talk to people. So I see so many bands from the Northeast. And so many of them are comprised of people who went to Berkeley. And you don't hear of them. I live in Kentucky. I don't hear of them necessarily down here, but I see all these great musicians in that part of the country, and so many of them went to Berkeley, that I used to call it the Berkeley effect. It's kind of, well, you have Sierra Hall on this album went to Berkeley. So you have that effect when they go to Berkeley, I believe. You have to be very talented to get in there, and you learn all these different musical theories, and you're exposed to all kinds of great music by the staff there, and then you leave, and you just kind of spread that. Your influence goes out a little bit from things you picked up. Maybe you're not even aware that you're doing it, but that there's that, I don't know how to explain it, there's that great resource that you can pull up, and you can add things to music, and I think it's a good thing. I mean, it's a great, I think the whole Berkeley effect is great.
Definitely, yeah, and just, like, I think living in Boston, you know, as a young, like, college-age kid, you're kind of, you know, if you're into roots music, you're looking up to all these bands that came before, and you, like, you know, you're a big Crooked Still fan, and Joy Comes Sorrow, and Deadly Gentlemen, and whoever else, and, you know, it kind of, and all those people, like, back when I was living in Boston, most of those people still lived in Boston, too, so you could, like, hang out with them, and see them at parties and stuff, so it kind of seemed like a very, like, possible thing. You'd kind of be like, well, they're doing it, like, that's something you can do, is start a band, and so, kind of cool.
Let me ask you this, and I'll get back to the album in a minute. So when you first heard bluegrass, and you took a liking to it, did you, before you started studying at Berkeley, obviously, did you kind of do research back to whatever you heard the first time? Did you search it back and find the origins of it? Looking for different styles of fiddle player, you just took a fancy to it, and
I wish I had.
You still can.
No, I know. I think I definitely heard like the newest stuff and got into it that way.
That's good.
It took me a little while to get to look back.
I want to talk about Natchez Whistle, which you have another great player, Chris Eldridge. Talk about that Hartford tune a little bit. Then I want to talk about a tune that you borrowed from Red Allen, as far as I can see. I looked it up, and I have it in my musical selections here, but we'll talk about that in a minute. But let's touch on Natchez Whistle and how you describe it in the album liner notes.
Yeah, Natchez. Man, that was one that I've been listening to for a while now, and it's one I was trying to get Mile 12 to do for a while, because I thought it was just a really cool tune, and we just never worked it up. It never sparked anything there, but I kept coming back to it. So when I was looking for material for the album, it was like, definitely came to mind as one that could be cool. So I sent it to Chris, and he liked it, and he came up with like sort of the setting for it. I think I was imagining more of like a bluegrass thing with like a full band, and he came up with this really cool finger picked guitar arrangement of it, which I would have never thought of, and I thought that was so cool. So we kind of pared it down to just fiddle and guitar and bass and vocals, and yeah, and it was so cool having Chris on the album and just getting to work with him. He played on that song, and he actually ended up playing guitar on North Garden, just because just for scheduling reasons. But he's a huge hero of mine. You know, I've been a huge fan of his playing with the Punch Brothers and for a long time.
He's got great chops. He did an album with them. We came to Grey Fox once and performed with Julian Lodge, who is a whole nother world away. And they did an album together, which you think, well, how do these guys match up perfectly? Because they both have all these little eddies in the music going around, but they seem to communicate really well. And Chris can do a lot of stuff. It's great. And he sings, you know, it's a John Hartford tune, and he doesn't really push the vocal, which John never did. You just kind of talk through it calmly. It's a really beautiful thing, which leads me to this. Talking about older songs and Chris's approach to Natchez Whistle, you chose a tune you found from Red Allen, and I think that's probably accurate. I don't know why. Yeah. You describe it as, and I've listened to the version that you listened to. I like yours much better because the tempo is so, well, the tempo is longer for one. You kicked up the tempo, but it's also a lot longer than the slower version from Red Allen. And I think you've got Tim on that. Is Tim and James Clee on that? Yeah.
James
okay.
Key.
Yeah, James yeah. Key. Yeah, that intrigues me. Why you found a song like that? What it is that, in your mind, you're going to make it yours or your approach to it? Because I think it's a better version because I like the up-tempo to that one.
Yeah, well, thank you, man. I mean, yeah, I guess I do a lot of digging, like, you know, old bluegrass song digging, trying to find stuff, material for the band and just things I think are interesting. And yeah, and, you know, one of my favorite things is, like, finding a song that's on the slower side and trying to figure out. I feel like one of the hardest things to find, or what has been hard for our Mile 12 to find, is, like, fast bluegrass songs that are cool, that we like, you know? So that was kind of another one that I was trying to figure out if it would work, how fast I could push it. I'd sometimes put it into, there's this app called Amazing Slow Downer.
Yes.
That you can,
I know it well.
Yeah, so you can put a track in there and speed it up. So I'll do that sometimes with songs and see what'll work. Sometimes then you just have to double time the music under the vocals and keep the vocals the same. But sometimes you can just speed everything up a bit. So that's what I was trying with.
And I really love this version. And let me just take a segue here for a minute. I'm talking to Bronwyn Keith Hines about her new album, Fiddler's Pastime. But you mentioned the Amazing Slowdowner. I know what that program is. But if I can summarize, what it does is allow you to change the tempo without changing the tones and the notes. They just get faster, and so you don't have like a cartoon version as you're speeding something up or slowing it down. It's the same notes, and everything is still in tune. It's a really neat. I haven't even thought about that for a long, long time. I forgot. I think I got that from Bill Evans years ago. So that's pretty. So
yeah,
I love that. I love that version. I love your version better than the original one. I like the tempo of it. I think you'd probably do this. Correct me if I'm wrong. Do you look for things as a band or as a performer for, you know, finding, you say it's hard to find sometimes up-tempo bluegrass. Well, there's lots of them, but you don't want to play the same one. So you want to find something else by an artist that maybe doesn't get that much exposure. Maybe it's upbeat. Maybe you can make it upbeat like you did with this Red Allen recording. But I would think that'd be something you'd want to do. Bring your own material to a band and your own material to your own album, but do you look for cuts that maybe were, this goes back a long, long time, might have been a B-side, I'm talking about 45 RPMs where there was an A and a B, do you look for stuff like that?
Totally. Yeah, totally, and man, they're still not easy to find at this point. I mean, I feel like the old bluegrass catalog has really been thoroughly dug through, and, you know, you'll find something cool, and then you realize Ricky Skaggs cut it 20 years ago.
Yeah. Well, 20 years is a long time. It's a whole generation, so you get to, yeah, but you want to find those things.
Once Ricky Skaggs has cut something.
Well, that's true. Yeah. That might be true, but I've heard artists tell me that before, that they look for the thing that's by an artist or a performer or a writer that they like that maybe didn't get as much exposure because it's good, it just didn't get, for whatever reason, it just didn't get pushed to the forefront, so...
The funny thing about this track was I'd found this one about a year ago, or about a year before I did the record, and I had it on a playlist, and I was like, yeah, this is going to be great. And then I kind of, I left it alone for a while, and then when I was looking for material for my album, I was like, oh, this will be perfect. I already researched it. No one has recorded it. It's going to be great. Or no one has recorded it in a long time. And I didn't like, bother to search it again and make sure no one had released it in the last couple months. And it turned out that Audie Blaylock recorded, like, a killer version
of
it.
Oh, is that right?
Released it last August.
Oh,
yeah.
Well.
So, and then I had no idea. So I, like, go ahead and record it. And, like, a couple months before my album release, I, like, hear Audie's version on Sirius. And I was like, oh, no.
Is the approach the same? Did he have that independent?
It's fairly similar.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we both just had the same idea, and he got to it about 6 months before I did.
You know,
yours
is a great version. I really enjoy it, and I want to talk to you now. We mentioned Sierra Hole, and I want to do this and get to a brief introduction by you to the tune an instrumental, Open Water, that features Sierra Hole, and then I'm going to have you introduce that as you're discussing it. Then I'll let you get back to your life and leave you alone for a while.
So that's one of my Open Water is one of my favorite instrumentals from the album. It's one I wrote back about a year ago. I was at the IBMA, the International Bluegrass Music Association event last year, and had some free time, so I was sitting in the lobby noodling around in G minor and came up with the A part for this one. And you know, I kind of had in mind a lot of fiddle and mandolin unison stuff on the melody, but you know, thinking of who would be good for that, I thought Sierra would be a really cool fit. So I asked Sierra Hole to play on this track, and I'm really happy with how it turned out. It's one of my favorites.
You both have great skill as a solo performer, but you also complement each other so well. To the audience, what I do when I have a guest on, there's no mystery to this. I talk to them beforehand about picking out two or three songs they'd like to specifically introduce. Open Water, I've played before on Unreal Bluegrass. And I was glad you chose it, because I think it's one of those instrumentals where everybody has enough room, nobody steps on each other, which is the part of the artistry involved in writing and then performing with someone. And when you with Sierra Hole, it's just a perfect combination of all those aspects.
Oh, man, thank you. That's,
yeah, sure.
That's really nice.
Well,
I don't know. That turned out cool.
Yeah, it's cool. Listen, so, all right, I will let you go, Bronwyn Keith Hines. Thanks so much for giving me your music, and to the audience of Unreal Bluegrass, thanks for putting this album out, and thanks so much for your time. I'll say goodbye to you, and I'll play for the audience Open Water that you've just described, and we'll all wait for venues to open up and for artists to be free and healthy so that we can go
sit and do this
again. You know, you need to have people respond to you, but we need to do it safely. We need to be there to be in the audience to hear you, to get that extra vibe from it, but we have to do it safely. So we'll wait.
Sure.
We'll wait,
but we'll
get back on the road again, I bet, soon.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
It'll happen.
It'll happen.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. I'll talk to you somewhere down the road.
Yeah.
All right. Bye-bye.
Yeah. All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.